Namaste. The Gita is one of the most wonderful scriptures in many ways. The first thing which strikes us about the Gita is that this profound wisdom, one of the most profound that human beings have ever received, has been given not in a quiet hermitage, not in a serene surroundings of an ashram life, but in the midst of the battlefield. This is something very unique and makes it very contemporary and relevant to all of us. Because very often human beings have this problem and they struggle with this idea that, well, we are too busy and we don't have really time to pursue spiritual life. Gita at once reconciles spiritual life with ghoram karmam, not just worldly life, but a life which is engaged in the most terrible of actions. So it starts itself, its narrative is a grand synthesis. So those who ask that, you know, how to reconcile spiritual life and material life, the very first reconciliation we find, of course, we find it in the Vedas, then it is lost. Again, we find in the Upanishads, again it is lost. Then the Gita revives it, but in a very grand way. It reminds me of the very second sloka of the Isha Upanishad, Kurvanneveha Karmani, a very powerful statement that, well, the path of karma is also the path of dharma. It is through this that you arrive at liberation. It is through this that you arrive at even transformation, anything. So it is this karma which opens the widest possible gateway towards the divine. So that is something very beautiful about the Gita. Second is that it's a very beautiful synthesis of the different aspects of human nature. Otherwise, ordinarily we have Jnana Yoga separate, Bhakti Yoga separate, Raj Yoga separate, Hatha Yoga separate, Karma Yoga separate. But the interesting part is we are not disembodied beings with different parts. In a human being, all these different parts are simultaneously present. And in any action that we take, they are operating together. So this is a knot of action that we are not like, you know, a Jnana Yogi says, I have nothing to do with my emotions. So it becomes a kind of one-sided approach toward the divine and not an integral movement. So in the Gita, what we find is, like the Isha Upanishad, an integral path. It is the integral path which takes us to the divine, meaning thereby we have to engage with the divine discovery and the divine manifestation in life with every aspect of our being. Nothing has to be left out. So this is the second very wonderful aspect of the Gita. Third is that the divine teacher in the Gita is no saint or a holy person sitting in the Himalayas or, you know, teaching us one principle or doctrine of action or one simple method. He is none else but the divine teacher, avatar, which is a rarest of rare fortune. And one place Sri Aurobindo says that if you had the great fortune of the avatar himself being your guru, then there are no limits to your realization. So, what is the difference? Well, normally we see that there are gurus, there are masters who teach us one way, one process, one method, and they help us through that process. For the rest, there is karma. And then we arrive at some kind of liberation. But when the divine takes up the human cloak, then by the very fact of his assumption, he takes upon himself all the challenges and difficulties and ordeals of the human race. It's a grace, an embodiment of grace. And that's what we see toward the end of the Gita. But at the same time, liberation or moksha is, I would say, it is something which is already given. But that's not the only thing. In the Gita, we see that Sri Krishna preaches the action of a Jivan Mukta, which is a state which is beyond what ordinarily we call as a liberation, which is withdrawing from the cycle of birth and death, which is okay for weak souls who, you know, want to escape from life and its so-called ordeals. But there are souls who aspire, and fortunately most of humanity want this terrestrial life to be perfect. And if we see or we are told that it's not possible, then the impulse to withdraw arises, because then there is a disappointed resignation from life. But the Gita doesn't take away that impulse. It speaks about that, you know, we are all working towards Lok Sangraha, towards a great grand fulfillment. The Gita doesn't tell us what that grand fulfillment will be, because, well, Sri Krishna has to come as Sri Aurobindo to reveal that. But at least it teaches human beings to take the path of action. And why act? Because it's not just about you and me and your community, your tribe. In the very beginning, we see this. This is how the Arjuna's dilemma starts, because He is a Kshatriya. To engage in the war is his natural Swadharma, and he has never shrunk from a battle because that's his Swadharma. But he suddenly realizes that this Swadharma is going to destroy the very motive for which he fights. Why does a Kshatriya fight? He fights for the protecting the righteousness, whom? For those who depend upon him. So we all, you know, who are the people who depend upon you? Your family members. And for their joy and everything, we engage in a battle. And nowadays the battle mode is changed, but it is for them that an average human being engages in battle. It may be a righteous battle, it may be a question of justice. But here he realizes that if he wins in the war, which is, he is not wrong in fighting a war because it's been thrust upon him. And as a Kshatriya, he is supposed to fight. But at the end of the war, he realizes that the very objective for which one normally fights a war, which is to see that one's family grows, prospers, that is not going to happen. On the contrary, the kutum, the kul will be degenerating. So when Shri Krishna takes up this question, this dilemma of Arjuna, it's very interesting. Within this small little question of Arjuna and answer of Shri Krishna, there is concealed a great secret. And the secret is that was a time when kutumb and kul was the highest. So if we look at the Mahabharata time, we had three main kul. Yadu kul, then there was Kuru kul, which, you know, had these mighty kings. And there was a third one in the, you know, on the side of Jarasandha and all, which ultimately Shri Krishna neutralized. So kul was regarded as the highest unit. Now what is Shri Krishna saying? That yes, kul will be lost. It may be lost, but there is something greater than kul. And for the first time, we see in a very authentic way, the first effort to establish a nation unit was Lord Rama going all the way down to Lanka. If you look at the journey, now they have a train, Ramayana train. So basically, it's tracing the journey of Rama. If you see, he establishes Aryavart on what is called a Jammudip. That's the first effort to establish a nation unit as something greater than the kul. And we see that which is hinted there comes in fullness in the life of Shri Krishna, where he actually establishes Bharatvarsh, which is subsequently guarded by many, many great hero warriors, because nation is the second stride of Vishnu. Nation unit is an important unit. Nation is the first unit where different kinds of people come together as a, it's a melting point of cultures, it's a melting point of different side shapes and colors of humanity, different ways of living coming together. Nation unit is the first unit. If one is not trained through the nation unit and speaks about internationalism, the chances are that there will be one kind of culture which will try to overrun all the rest. So nation unit is the second stride of Vishnu, which Shri Krishna establishes. Once that is established, then we see we are ready for the third stride, and that Sri Aurobindo speaks about human unity. Of course, we have these hints here and there. So this is the time when there is a second stride of Vishnu to be taken, and kul has to be subordinated to a larger impulse, which is the nationhood. Now this we know, that today when a soldier fights on the forefront, if he starts thinking of kul, he'll probably not fight at all. He will be like Arjuna. But thanks to the Gita, that prana has ka sanchar ho gaya jeevan mein. The new thought has gone into mankind. That no, the nation unit is larger, and you sacrifice the lower for the larger, the lesser for the greater. And therefore today, without knowing the Gita, without reading about it, though it's, I must say that, you know, it's continues to inspire soldiers. Many of them have this war cry in India, at least Indian soldiers, Har Har Mahadev, Jai Bhavani. And very interestingly, if you have heard this, an aside but worth exploring, if you go to Leh Ladakh, and if you are going through these army units, there are such wonderful lines from the Gita. And similarly in Gangtok, if you go towards the Indo-Tibetan border, so as you are going higher and higher, you will see those wonderful passages, some line from the Gita, which are so inspiring. And you realize that the Gita's action is not limited to the battlefield of Kurukshetra, but all battlefields of life. And it inspires, you know, it's wonderful to know that we are not here just to preserve a little family and to look after the, you know, little needs of a little life. Well, that's okay, that's required, that's a kind of dharma to take care of the family. But wherever there is a clash of dharma, standards of conduct, then we have to always sacrifice the lower for the higher. This is the basic principle that the Gita brings in. And to an extent, Arjuna is able to follow it. For instance, first tendency in him is a sensational recoil, the vital recoil, egoistic aim. I am a smartest kshatriya, the most powerful dhanurdhar. So what are these people in front of me? That's how an egoistic person will react. That's how Karna reacts. That's how Duryodhana reacts. You know, that is the reaction. Duryodhana is also a kshatriya. But how does he react? He says in front of Bhishma, Drona, Bhurishrava, Karna, Krapacharya, this army that stand before is nothing but a shuni. It's negative. It's something, nothing. It cannot stand us. But Arjuna has already overcome the dilemma that an egoistic person faces. In fact, an egoistic person doesn't face a dilemma. That's the interesting part. He just is living for his ego, and wherever he gets his self-interest fulfilled, he acts. So facing a dilemma is the sign that we are at least one notch above the ordinary average human level, where we act and think later. That's how an average humanity is. We act under an animal impulse. And what is called in the West, this is regarded as the highest possibility of humanity, when we are taught that man is a social animal and survival of the fittest is the very goal of evolution. Whoever gave this doctrine had not read the Gita and was not conversant with much, much, much higher layers of thought that we discover in, you know, Indian thought. So the first tendency, the egoistic person who lives for vital enjoyment, for the sake of ambition, that is taken care of by Arjuna. Arjuna knows that this is not how he should act. In the very first, people often ask who is greater than, you know, between Arjuna and Karna. One doesn't have to think twice. Look at the man's choice. He was not trying to prove a point. Why was he recoiling? Not out of fear, not out of anything. He could have decimated the whole army with Pashupata Astra and all these things at his command. It would have taken him a moment to do it. And look at the maryada of the mighty and the strong. He is not there that I have to settle a score with Karna, I have to prove a point. No. He realizes that this battle, if I fight, okay, I will win the battle. That he knows. He has no doubt about it. And with Krishna by his side, 100% he is going to win. But he says, what will I do with this victory? Isn't it an egoistic action? So this way he has already crossed the very first dilemma that a person would act between an egoistic, selfish standard and a transpersonal standard. So what is the second standard is? Well, it's not about winning or losing, but as a kshatriya he must fight. This is the second aspect of the dilemma, that he is called upon to act according to the kshatriya dharma. And kshatriya dharma is to protect the righteous. It is to take care of those who are weak. So he is called upon to fight this battle. And I must say that in ancient Indian thought, and I'm sure all this is already done, so I'll not spend much time on it. But this swadharma is so important. The Gita speaks about it. Swadharma is our inbuilt mechanism, to put it in modern language. It is our unique path of evolution. And the Gita is given to primarily to a kshatriya, the pragmatic man. It's not given to a philosopher and thinker. Philosopher and thinker will not have this dilemma. He will not even be in the battle. And he'll say, let's debate and discuss whether one should be violent or non-violent. He's a man who has never seen action. You know, often people used to ask, sometimes I have been asked this question. I must tell you that these dilemmas can come very uniquely. I have a very good friend, infantry commando, facing, he has seen one of our soldiers being, you know, caught by the terrorist, chopped, hacked, and you know, sent. And these people, they are capable. I mean, Indian commandos, they can ransack and, you know, destroy, and they have been held back by the unit. That this is not how we should behave. And he says that when you are moving in that region where now fortunately things are better because of, you know, that 370 gone, but he says there are people who will wear a burqa, but they are terrorists. So, but you can't shoot, you can't ask that lift a burqa. He says we have to go by instinct. Sometimes instinctively you feel that here is somebody whom you have to shoot. Now there is no time even to think at that point of time. Here it is like you are defending something and your own life is at stake. This one part, one kind of story. So second aspect of, as a kshatriya, this is what he is called upon to do. Regardless of the human rights and the things, he's a kshatriya. This is impulse to, you know, he is born for this, to protect, to defend, and he has to do it at any cost. This dilemma is on one side, this is the, let's take his inner battlefield. On the other side, there are his emotions. There is attachment. There is moha. Okay, fine, I'll fight. I'll defend. I'll defend those who depend on my strength and my prowess. But who are these people whom I have to fight? My own guru, my own family members, my own grandsire. I have slept in his lap many a times. He has fed me with his own hands. How can I do this? For whom will I fight this battle? At the end, even when I am, some people are saved. These are the ones for whom I would have enjoyed, they are gone. So this crisis takes another form. It's not the crisis of an egoistic person, but the crisis of a sensational, emotional person. Arjuna is shown in this. You see, it's very beautiful that if you look at the, analyze the characters of the Mahabharata, I just enjoy doing this. Arjuna is uniquely chosen for this yoga. If you look at it, he is the only person in the, out of the six Pandavas, if I may use the word, but definitely five Pandavas and Karna, who is really an integral personality. He is a warrior, of course. He also, you know, plays tabla. He knows how to dance. He's very emotional. He can be very, you know, what Kapir says, seemingly frivolous. And at the same time, Arjuna lives by some high standards, noble standards. So some very unique composition whom Sri Krishna chooses as his instrument in the battlefield. So the second level of crisis is that there is my Swadharma. I must fight. But against whom? My own people. Should I do it or should I not do it? Now there was once a question which Sahanadi had asked Sri Aurobindo. She said that somebody within the ashram set up, he spoke something against Sri Aurobindo and the mother. She says, I had my blood boiling and I wanted to tell him all kinds of things. Probably she said. She said, but after that, some sadhak was telling her, no, you should have reacted with equanimity. She asked Sri Aurobindo, what should I have done? Then Sri Aurobindo gives her the doctrine of the Gita. And he says, on one side, while it's true that hatred and cursing are not the right attitude, and to practice equanimity is the fundamental basis. But then he says, the question is this all that is demanded of us? And then he says, if that is the case, then Sri Krishna would have only confirmed the sannyasin's impulse in Arjuna. So there is something more, and that's what we find hinted in the Gita, is the dynamic equality, and from there a new journey starts. So this idea of absorbing the shocks of the world is fundamental requirement. At one place, but Sri Aurobindo says very beautifully, while it's not good to engage in personal battles, you know, somebody told something to me and I'm going to avenge, this is okay for movie themes and it's absurd at the bottom. But it's not always noble when there are others who are involved. When at one place he even uses the very interesting aphorism where he says, when pardon, forgive, but when possible, avenge calmly. And somebody asked that, what does Sri Aurobindo speak about avenge? Avenge calmly is about upholding justice. Justice is a divine aspect. And when you don't do that, then you create another kind of imbalance in the world. You know, much talk goes about forgiving. Yes, forgiveness is good. And there should be no hatred ever in... hatred spoils. Hatred takes away the possibility of true action. But at the same time, just imagine that there is a thief who has stolen. And you say, I forgive him. You are a noble person. Great. Your name will be written in the annals of Gandhian philosophy. Here was a person. A thief came, stole everything from his home. And he told him, you take this little bit also from my house. How wonderful. But what happens to the thief? Thief discovers, wow, wonderful. He steals from another home. Now, if you have the capacity and if you don't hold the hand of the thief, you are actually encouraging a tendency which is not always healthy. Now this is the second aspect which Sri Aurobindo brings it out in the Gita, where he says that we want this world to become clean and wonderful, but we want to keep our hands clean. Somebody else should do the dirty job. He says that's not, and that's what has happened in the entire Gandhian philosophy, non-violence. If Hitler attacks, you're not going to stand with lathi and say, I'm going to take a Dandi march or do a protest against the violence of Hitler. He will say, wonderful. But there will be some people who have to fight. So what you have done, you have kept your hands clean. But at the same time, you have allowed a monstrous force to sweep into the country, into the world. And that's why we see Sri Krishna's actions, which many people, you know, find it very difficult to understand. Sri Krishna's action when he suddenly changes apparently the whole environment, and, you know, people often ask, why did he do these means which are called as foul? You know, why did he allow Jayadrath to be killed in the way he was killed? Why did he give this idea of Bhishma Pitama or killing of Dronacharya, killing of Karna? You see, look at the beauty and the wonder of Sri Krishna. Sri Krishna is not bothered whether what people will call him. That's the last thing he is concerned about. He is bothered about which way the civilization will go. Yes, people will call him. They call him names. But thanks to Sri Krishna that today India was born, India was saved. At one point, Sri Aurobindo says that thanks to Sri Krishna, through the Mahabharata war, India was saved. Yes, there was bloodshed. Nobody understood. Gandhari cursed him. They didn't understand. You could have stopped the war. All of them would have listened. Had Krishna confirmed the ascetic impulse in Arjuna, had Krishna just little bit told Yudhishthira, you know, it's okay, but don't you think it'll be unfair to kill your own people? And if Yudhishthira and Krishna, Bhima could be managed. Bhima was a little more difficult to manage, or he may have gone into the war, killed a few, and then. But Krishna doesn't do that. On the contrary, he does just the opposite. And till date, people don't understand Krishna's action. Why? Because there are moments in the history of mankind when it's not about you, when it's about a civilization, when it's about setting a higher and nobler standard. Imagine if Krishna had not confirmed the warrior impulse in Arjuna. Perhaps what would have happened to India down the ages? Shubhendu says this in Bangla writings, that thanks to that war and Sri Krishna confirming this aspect, that for the next how many years, 4,500 years roughly, the Mahabharata war, when did the invasion start? Say about 1,000 years. For 3,000 plus years, right up to Chandragupta Maurya, great hero kings defended this nation. It's amazing, that action of Sri Krishna. It didn't end with the war. Nor does the Gita end with the war. So this is the second level, that yes, you must paradharma bhayavaha swadharma nidhanam shreya. If such is your impulse, act upon it. So Sri Krishna Sri Aurobindo confirms to Sahana Devi that look here, while practicing equanimity is one aspect, but to stand for truth, especially in the world battle, if it's an individual liberation, it's perfectly fine, because I don't concern, this is Maya. But where we understand that there is a larger issue at stake, then it's no more a question of individual battle. And she says, we are here to establish a truth against which there are immense forces of falsehood that are arrayed against it. And if to, you know, be indifferent and stand apart is justified, then there is equal justification for standing against these forces and taking up arms if necessary. So this is the mighty answer that Sri Krishna gives. So this dilemma at the second level he resolves. But then he says, yet, but isn't it my duty also to protect? Arjuna is that moment. Sri Krishna brings out from Arjuna everything that modern man will face. It was not Arjuna speaking. That Sri Aurobindo clears. Several times when you use Sri Aurobindo, Sri Krishna comes, and Sri Krishna, Sri Aurobindo comes. So please take it as synonymous. So Sri Aurobindo, in Bangla writings, he says that it was Sri Krishna who brought out of Arjuna these crises. See, this is something very interesting. When we are in face to face with a crisis, actually who has brought out the crisis? The same one. It is his play. And why he has brought that crisis out of us? So that we can take the next step. Why? Because we are, you know, often we think God plays a spoil sport. Yes, sometimes it looks like that. But he plays the spoil sport so that we can engage in a greater play and a better play. So that's exactly what next happens, that he says, but what about my duty? Kshatriya dharma is okay, but my duty. So he is caught in an ethical dilemma. And he doesn't know if he fights the battle as a Kshatriya, which he must. He's right. But equally, if he stands by the side of his grandsire to protect him, he's equally right. He should actually be safeguarding the interest of Drona. He'll be equally right. So what side he should take? So these dilemmas come in human life, which where we are confronted between two mutual rights. It's not about a right and a wrong. That is easier. But two mutual rights, both things are equally right. At least they seem equal. So what should we do next? And next comes the whole of Gita. And what is the essence of that? The essence of it is that all crises, though outwardly they seem a crisis of events and situations, are at their bottom evolutionary crises. They are a call to grow and evolve beyond the limited frames in which we live. Even ethics is a frame. Morality is a frame. And these frames are all right. They help us to navigate through ordinary human life. But there are moments when we have to go beyond the frame. What should we do then? And Gita brings it out very forcefully. But we see the same thing happening in Ramayana. In Ramayana, when Mirabai asked Tulsidas, "What shall I do? My family members expect me to be a Shakti Upasak, so I have to eat meat. But I am a Vaishnava. I love Krishna. What do I do?" So Tulsidas, that famous letter where he quotes from Ramayana, he says, "Bali Guru Tejo Vibhishan Bandhu Bharat Mehtari." He says, my opinion, if you ask my 2 cents worth, it is, "Jaake priyana Ram vaidehi, so chhaadiye koti vairi sang jaddapi param sanehi." He who is not on the side of the divine, let me paraphrase it, don't be standing by his side, even to defend him, because that is adharma. You are using dharma, so-called dharma, in an intellectual way to perpetuate adharma. There is a line in Savitri in the world of falsehood, where Shubhendu describes this state where he says, "And led to perdition through the heavenward path." I am being very virtuous. I am being very righteous. So thought Karna. So thought perhaps Drona. So thought Kripacharya. But it was led to perdition through a heavenward path. As if I am doing something great, something righteous. So we must understand that this ethical and moral standards can sometimes lead us to situations. For example, I often use this situation in the modern Indian context. Because now fortunately things have changed thanks to the new consciousness. The Nari of today is a Shakti. But a generation back, what was the state of the Bahu? Now the Saas ka wahi state ho gaya hai. But what was the state of the Bahu? They were sons who were told, and this was everywhere, by the way, this is not about India. All over the world, the women were regarded as a second or a third rate citizens. By the way, in India, things are better. World over, they are still a pleasure object. Still not given a seat where they deserve. They are still treated for advertisement of products. And we rejoice in the way they dress and all this because they are still treated as if they are nothing else but people who are meant to give us pleasure. But in India, things are changing, fortunately. This to put the record straight. But still, when we go back just a generation before, what was the state of the Bahu? And what was the poor husband, not so poor husband, swinging between Mama Papa's voice and my wife's, command or her dilemma, her situation. And what was the average man's response? They are my parents. How can I, ignore them? It went sometimes to an extreme, and these extreme cases reminded us. They were like a recoil and shock. They awakened us. Where people were actually burning, not people, but incidents took place. Where for the sake of parents and their greed, a lady was burnt. This has happened. Not as many as what, BBC and New York Times reported. But yes, at time. But this shook the conscience of a nation. And we began to wonder, is it really right? Do we have to listen to parents under all circumstances? Bharat said no, the land of Rama. No, not under all circumstances. So what are the circumstances where you have to go beyond morality? See, morality is all right in ignorance. It's a good stuff. But there is a greater standard. That's what the Gita comes to tell us. And that greater standard comes where we go to the root of the word dharma. Dharma is about what? Why do we want to practice a dharma? Dharma is to help in the manifestation of the eternal truth which is behind. So there is the two aspects of dharma. One is that truth which holds this creation. Second, it's manifesting itself. So what deed, what thought, what feeling, what impulse, what action, what will is going to help in the manifestation of that truth? So when we look at it from that standpoint, sometimes, or not so few times, but sometimes, often enough, it is good to stay the hands of the slayer with force if necessary. Why? Because if you let him go on a ransack and rampage, it will lead to a state of utter anarchy. It will destroy the very purpose of the divine in creation. Freedom never means that, democracy never means that, putting in modern context, that everybody has their own freedom. And even in understanding of democracy, everybody has a right, provided you don't trespass another person's right. So this is how people are trying to balance out. But ultimately, what is the deeper crisis? It's a spiritual crisis. All crises, whatever they may seem on the surface, are at their bottom spiritual crisis. And this crisis takes two forms, individual and a collective crisis. So what really is a spiritual crisis? Spiritual crisis is essentially that there are two kinds of forces acting upon the world since the origin of creation. And Sri Krishna uses the word which is more convenient from the practical point of view, the Asura and the Deva. So what is the difference between them? Asura is the tendencies which are leading us towards downward, which give us the feeling that the body is all, vital enjoyment is everything. They are tendencies toward downward gravitation. Live life for the sake of the ego, for the sake of desire. World has been created by desire. These philosophies, these ideologies, which do not take into cognizance that man is anything more than an animal, they are the forces of downward gravitation. The asura lives only to feed. He is a glutton. He feeds his greed. So these tendencies in man are the asuric tendencies. And where do they come from? They are forces of retrogression. And there are the evolutionary forces, of which Arjuna is one of the prototypes, which are forces of upward endeavor. All effort at self-mastery is a force of upward endeavor. And that's exactly what Arjuna is doing. He is very clear about it. So he is being called upon. He looks within himself and he wants to make sure that he doesn't act under any lower impulsion. So these are the two forces acting at any point of time. Arjuna is already a godlike nature. So Sri Krishna tells him, you don't worry. I know you are not acting under an asuric impulsion. That credit goes to those fellows. They are also warriors, but they are acting only for selfish motives. So then still he doesn't know, what should I do? So first thing he tells is, stand back from this entire field of action, then look at life. Don't think I am personally involved. My kul, my people, my this, my. Stand back. So we have the yoga of the intelligent will, buddhi yoga. And he says buddhi is greater that time than this kind of blind karma. So Arjuna says, sir, what are you saying? You are saying buddhi is greater? He says, yes, because it will give you the basis for action. If you act under any situation driven by the whirlpool of forces, you will be caught. Learn to step back, and it takes time. So when you step back, then you discover that there is, I am none of this whirlpool, and you step back. And from that yoga, what does buddhi do? It should refer to something greater. That's the purpose of buddhi. So buddhi yoga means turn the buddhi upward to unite with the divine. So that's the first step, he tells him. And then he tells him, well, it's not for your personal gain. Arjuna, please leave that aside. It's not about, you know, who won the war and who will enjoy the kingdom, who will survive. None of these things are valid arguments. Nishkam karma. Sir, you are saying that do nishkam karma, be in a state of equanimity, sthit pragya. Again, you are asking me to fight. Why are you asking me to fight? So, Sri Krishna says next level after buddhi yoga and karma, it takes him to bhakti. He says, Arjuna, for a moment, can you just forget all this and just look at me, love me, be full of me? Okay, fine, I'm full of you. So what happens when I'm full of you? I'll have Maitri and Karuna for everybody. Again, Arjuna is confused. I'll have Maitri and Karuna for everybody. Now you want me to fight? Yes, for the love of God, fight. Not love of God. See how this can be distorted. Not love of God, my God, and therefore I must fight. That's not the God of the Gita. The God of the Gita is a universal deity. Vishwarup. All he absorbs. All are his. All are his children. Countless manifestations. How do I fight for the love of God? He is in everything, everywhere. Ghat kat me wo noor samaya. Why should I fight? Because in the manifestation, it's a progressive unfolding. What was yesterday's dharma becomes adharma of today. See, if we look at life, there was a time when people gave human sacrifice. It was required at that primitive age. That look, and you know who was sacrificed? The person who was the best and fittest. If you had a defect in nature, you can't be sacrificed. Now, sounds so barbarous and crude. Some people say in India, used to have human sacrifice. Yes, but you had gladiators, just to put the record straight. So we were not doing that. We were sacrificing at the altar of Kali, not in the arena. That strong one can finish the other one. So yes, human sacrifice is tribal way back. But it was a reminder that an individual can never be greater than the collectivity. This was a very, I must say. Then things changed. Then it was, if called upon, man should sacrifice himself, his life, for the sake of the community he lives in. So this was the next truth. It was no more human sacrifice in the terms of Bali. But it was in a war, in, you know, when people were. Then the next level was, human is gone, animal sacrifice. Again, primitive societies. So animal sacrifice. Animal sacrifice as if the goddess will be pleased. In all likelihood, if the goddess appeared, she will say, sacrifice the animal inside you. That was the next level. Human beings evolved further. Many are still living in that animal sacrifice. But there are those who understand that the sacrifice of the animal is within me. Because then only I become a human being. If the animal in me, the vital man, is very active, there is no chance that I am a human being. I'll look like a human being. I won't have horns. I won't have a tail and probably not big nails. I'll have tattoos all over. And with scorpion and God knows what. And though I'll be human being in my looks, yet I won't be a human being. Why? Because the animal is active. It is, we become a human only when by the moral impulse in us, we sacrifice and subordinate the animal. We know we are feeling greedy for something. But we realize that no, this is not the right thing to do. But then how do we go beyond humanity? And the whole Gita comes to reveal to us that. That there is something more than you and me and this, your immediate people at stake. And in the evolutionary unfolding of man, he must do always to strive towards establishing higher and higher standards of conduct. So how will I know that? Well, by the divine unfolding. Seek it in the divine. Whatever leads towards vastness. Sometimes even a war is necessary to lead humanity through a narrow gorge towards a vaster field. So whatever leads towards that, whatever leads towards the impulse of unity, again the paradox comes. What kind of unity that Arjuna must fight Duryodhana and his tribe? If Duryodhana and his tribe win, there is no chance of any unity for 1,000 years. If Yudhishthir wins, there is a chance that there will be a legitimate world unity, at least an Indian unity. So it was a war which went to that extreme where the very unity of mankind was threatened. And that's why when the war is over, Sri Krishna engages, or rather Yudhishthir engages in a Ashwamedh Yagya. Before the war, it's Rajasu Yagya, then Ashwamedh Yagya. What was Ashwamedh Yagya? It was not war. It's like now we want to establish a larger unity. And if you accept, you have our protection, our military. It's a modern way of like, you know, you'll have a common military. If a kingdom accepts that, well, we come under this emperor, then Yudhishthira's responsibility is to protect, to feed, to do everything which is necessary. But they will understand that here is the emperor and I am the king. So if the emperor commands, if there is a common war, then they join hand. This is all that it meant. So the larger unity is more important, sometimes for which a war is necessary. With regard to Pakistan, when somebody asked Aurobindo, came Munshi, he said, Pakistan has been created by falsehood, fraud and farce. It must go, even if necessary by force. And 71, this is exactly what the mother said, when people were, you know, Indian army was at the doorsteps of Lahore and Karachi, and they sent a message, oh, we are going to have our dinner in Karachi, and they were told, no, 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 come back. This was because they were impelled by the divine force. The divine mother has spoken about that war, 71 war. The divine mother was behind it because this was needed for the unity. We didn't heed that. Look at the result. All the bleeding of the nation, the terrorism, the Kashmir problem, everything started subsequent to that. How will the unity come about now? The mother said Pakistan will split into different parts. Look at it. Division to create unity. And then they will come together and there will be a confederation of nations at some point. Because Akhand Bharat is necessary for the divine working. It's not an ideology of one party or another party. Akhand Bharat is a necessity for the world to survive. Because where is the light other than that? I often use this word, I'm just making it contemporary. Look at the basic guiding lights in the world. Western democracy, with its stress upon the body and the vital as the ultimate acme of man, and reason, which as long as you are privately sinning and doing everything, it's fine. Don't do it in public. Don't create public nuisance. Or the Chinese, or the Islamic ideology. Where is that truth which can save the world? But India. But India must become one. So I'm just connecting it, that why it is so important. Why is Krishna on the battlefield speaking about saving Aryavart for the sake of the future of mankind? So this is how we have to look at it, that ultimately it is not about me, mine or others. It's about the divine will and the divine command. And divine will is not something fixed. It is progressively unfolding. To one person, if Buddha asked Shri Krishna, if at all, or as Sri Aurobindo says in Essays on the Gita, it is not about duty. To each one, the divine will unfolds very differently. So if Buddha went and asked Shri Krishna, what should I do? I am besieged by this impulse to save mankind. I see death, suffering. I want to go and find a solution. Shri Krishna would have said, go and find the solution. If Sri Ramakrishna would have asked him, I am seized with this impulse, Godward impulse. So Sri Krishna would say, put all in the bonfire and be seized with this impulse. But that's not the question of Arjuna. So to Arjuna, who is a warrior, Sri Krishna confirms that fight the war, not for yourself, but for the life of humanity. There is a very beautiful aphorism of Sri Aurobindo, after which we will read a passage and close. But the most important thing is that divine will doesn't express itself in a uniform way. When people try to standardize anything spoken by, you know, the Gita is not about, we must fight. Why? Because in the Gita there is spoken about fight. Gita doesn't do that. It takes us to a transhuman, suprahuman standard. And what is that suprahuman standard? The final word, sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam braja. That is the ultimate truth. Follow my command, follow my will. What that command will be, we don't know. To Sri Aurobindo, the command was to go from that battlefield of Kurukshetra into a larger battlefield of humanity, where he would fight ultimately from that small room, the battle of the future. So we should not standardize into this or that. The principle here is that beyond your personal human standards, when we don't know, we must refer to the divine will. Then what is all this peace, equanimity about? It is the state to receive the divine will. If we are acting under preferences, under desire, under egoistic impulsions, selfish things, considerations of family, this, that, even nation, we will miss the point. The point is when these things are quietened, then we receive the divine command in the quietude of our heart, and then we must follow it. After that, there should be no questioning why and what. And this divine command will come differently to different people. And even if it takes us through an evolutionary process, it's not like fixed forever. So this is the basic essence. All crises at their bottom are evolutionary crises. And there are forces which pull us down. There are forces which help us grow. And we should take the side of the evolutionary progression within us and within all. With regard to war, Shobindu puts it so beautifully. He says, respect human life, but respect more the life of humanity. Men die so that man may live and God is born. So these are things where we have to always keep in mind the larger good of a civilization about a race, which is more important than our immediate selfish needs and selfish desires. So this is the essence. Whenever we are faced with a conflict, always we will see one path leads us to growth, evolution, upward. Another path holds us either to the same position or it takes us down. For each one, the answer will be different. One has to figure it out within oneself. But always to strive upward, to progress toward divine, what little shift inside me will take me closer to the divine? That is what is important. So this is very powerful. So I'll close with this. One of my favorites from Essays on the Gita. And Shri Krishna's reply to Arjuna in the very beginning. It is the creed of the Aryan fighter. He is addressing the pragmatic man that Arjuna is. We all have within us a fighter. We all have within us a poet. And we all have within us a philosopher. And we all have within us, thankfully, a little bit of a madman who rescues us from sanity and the boundaries of sanity. Don't take it seriously, but it is true. It is the creed of the Aryan fighter. What is the creed? No God. Now you see, he is answering to love your neighbor. Before you love your neighbor, you must first know God. He is not saying love yourself, because we may catch it in this way, that love my little self, egoistic self. Know God, first thing. It says, know thyself, help man. This urge to help mankind is a larger impulse. It liberates us from our littleness. Protect the right. Right with a capital R. Which means it's not just about, everybody has their own definition of right. Right here is coming with a capital R, which means the rhythm, the writh, the right arrangement of things. We must protect that. There is a divine law, divine order in this universe. And we must respect that. This right means also, if you see somebody chopping a tree mercilessly, you can tell the person that, look here, this is something which is going to harm. But if he says to chop one tree because I have to make a road which is necessary and I am going to plant 10 trees, then you say, okay. So it depends. You can't make an absolute rule out of it. So you have to do that right. Do without fear of weakness or faltering thy work or battle in the world. Fear of being judged. So what? Human beings will anyways judge you. Like Kallu ka gadha. Whatever you do. If you are in the public eye, some will say very nice. Some will say horrible. Some will say this, that. Nothing matters. The only person's opinion matters is God's. And he doesn't have opinions. He knows our truth. And he is ever ready to help us. That's all. All other opinions, viewpoints are all meaningless. To start thinking of social opinions, viewpoint, that's very elementary. That has to be left far behind even to be a noble human being. So opinions, viewpoints. Thou art the eternal and imperishable spirit. I am not this little formation, my little family, my little surname, my little degree, my little visiting card. Throw it out of the window. Thou art the eternal imperishable spirit. Thy soul is here on its upward path to immortality. What am I here for? What's my business? My business is to move upward on the path of immortality. Immortality means vastness, to discover the infinite, To discover the eternal is to discover the imperishable soul. That is immortality. Immortality is not preservation of the body and my little personality. Oh, I'll become immortal. So, till God knows when, this little body and this little self will remain the same. There will be a curse like Ashwatthama's. If one wants the name to be preserved, be as a Vyasa. You know, that's how people, if at all, or a Yajnavalk, and I am not bringing Sri Aurobindo, he is far beyond. And Sri Krishna, we should not even, you know, that's the immortality. Yes, eventually the body, but that's the last limit. Life and death are nothing. It's, as Sri Aurobindo says, that it's for fools to annoy this idea of death. What is death? Actually, it doesn't exist. It's actually nothing. It's simply a changeover. The body undergoes these processes, not I. So to know that imperishable spirit, life and death, I am born today here. Next I'll be born somewhere. It brings automatically a wideness in the mind. That today I am born, you know, in India. Tomorrow I may be born here, there, other places. Hopefully except China. But, you know, who knows, you know, but there also, after all, God can express in different ways. No? Who knows? So, you know, we are in, this brings the wideness. Psychic being understand this. Oh, so you are not attached to one particular way of life. It liberates us from that. Life and death are nothing. Sorrow and wounds and suffering are nothing. They savor, the strong savor it like a strengthening wine. अच्छा बाण लग गए नैनो वाले नहीं शब्दों वाले दोनों ही बाण डजंट मैटर दे आर नथिंग वन गिव्स प्लेजर द अदर गिव्स पेन इट्स ओके दे आर नथिंग दैट्स नॉट इंपॉर्टेंट सो ही सेज दे आर नथिंग फॉर दीज थिंग्स हैव टू बी कॉन्कर्ड एंड ओवरकम इफ दे कम अपॉर्चुनिटी टू ओवरकम सो ऑल ऑफ देम इज ए ग्रेस. Look not at thy own pleasure and gain and profit, but above and around, above at the shining summits to which thou climbest, never to forget the goal. Whether battle or ashram or life or married or sannyasi, none of this is relevant and important what we are doing outwardly. Important is where I am going. There is a very nice Richard Bach's book, Illusions, no? Where you stand is not important. What is important is where you are going. It's the only thing. You may be a sannyasi, but all the time bothering about what I'll eat next, and you know, I'm a senior sadhak or a junior sadhak. Irrelevant. Important thing is where I'm going. Around at this world of battle and trial in which good and evil, progress and retrogression are locked in stern conflict all over the world, in house, within us, then with people around us, families, and with larger context, nation, in the world, we see that, you know, they are always locked, and the battle in this age is being fought at the level of the mind, iterative battle. In Sri Krishna's time, it was a heroic age, Dwapar Yug. So vital battle were fought with the vital powers. Now, it is not Pashupat Astra and, you know, Brahma Astra and Agni Astra. They are there, but they are driven by idea forces. Of course, they are there when you have, you know, nuclear missile, Brahmos. But now they are not driven by, you know, the way we use that heroic age. Now it is the idea. If it falls in the hands of whatever that fellow's name is, Kim likes, North Korea. Sri Aurobindo was asked this question. He said the whole thing is clear as a pike staff. When people said, oh, why is America meddling in North Korea's affairs? He said it's necessary, otherwise this is the way China will push and enter into this world. So one has to have open eyes and see. One can't say that, no, it doesn't matter to me. It's only when it, how does it affect me? This kind of an indifference. The supramental takes interest in the world affairs, but not the way we take into interest. We take interest. So look around. in which good and evil, progress and retrogression are locked in stern conflict. And every level you have this dilemma. I can give one small example quickly. Physical relation when you are married is right or wrong? No. Most people will say it's legitimate. What if the wife says no? Why? Because, well, she doesn't want. That's it. No reasons needed. Is it still right or wrong? Now humanity is facing these dilemmas. Otherwise, it's legitimate. So you see how the sense of right and wrong changes? What if your child wants to drop your surname? He's living in a wider state. He doesn't want to carry the burden of. So all these things, now things are changing. It's very fast track evolution. So what was right yesterday is not right and legitimate today. What if two people love each other and want to stay together and two people are married but don't love each other? Now these are dilemmas we have to face and the Gita will help us. Which is right, which is wrong? See, I am not giving answers, I have mine. But these are dilemmas which humanity is facing and is going to face more and more. So, men call to thee, their strong man, their hero for help. Help then, fight. Don't shrink from a battle which has been thrust upon you legitimately. But then, destroy when by destruction the world must advance. Sometimes you have to clear the path to make a road through. You have to do it. You can't say that time, no, I'll not destroy anything. I want to be a goody person. Yes, you'll be very goody. There'll be some people who will play guitars and say, so wonderful, you know. He's a good guy. But you have not done what you are meant to do. Sometimes you have to destroy because, you know, there are things standing on the way. So destroy if by destruction the world must advance. But hate not that which thou destroyest. This is what is the inner change required. It's not out of hatred, anger or any of these feelings. But because of the work to be done, divine will to be fulfilled in this world. Do thy work with a calm, strong and equal spirit. Shubhendu himself had sent some of his disciples and their children into the Second World War. Do thy work with a calm, strong and equal spirit. Equal means there is no raga dvesh. It's not about my prestige, my honor, I must win, I must succeed at any cost. Equal spirit, whatever result come. But do what you are within that urge is there in the divine will, how it expresses itself. Fight and fall nobly or conquer mightily. Don't shrink from either. Don't calculate. If you calculate, you can't act. Because mind will say advantages, disadvantages, plus minus. Swadharmo nidhanam shreya par dharmo bhayavaha. For this is the work that God and thy nature has given to thee to accomplish. So Swadharma is the first guiding light. Not all these ideas of human opinions, duties, etc. And even this has to be finally surrendered. When even Swadharma cannot guide, that's the problem of Arjuna. Then the final last word is Sarvadharman Parityajya Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. Take refuge in the divine and act based on how his will expresses within us. We may misread the will, doesn't matter. It may happen. Remember and offer. Keep referring back to him. Keep referring back to him. He knows how to tune us to the smallest detail of action. Thank you. If any questions, I'll be very happy to take. We have 5 minutes perhaps. I don't know.
Thank you, Alabda, for this enlightening lecture and actually bringing out the different stages of dilemma that Arjuna faced and how we can learn and work towards that progressive evolution. We'll take few questions. Yeah, Mananji, you can go ahead first.
Yes, Manan. Namaste.
Namaste, Alabda. Lots of gratitude, so much to absorb. You talked about the evolutionary march and, you know, the progressive unfolding of the divine will. And then you talked about how the level of aggregation keeps growing wider and vaster from Kul Kutumba to the nation unit. And now, obviously, especially in the last century, it's taken on a new spiral, because there is both in terms of potential and manifestation, the world is getting so much more closer, right? And also again in the last 2 years. So, the discovery of the Swabhava is a key essence in the teaching of the Gita. And my own experience is that it is very much a function also of action in the collective. So, isn't it a paradox to be resolved as a country that to create a win-win outcome where more people are able to discover their own Swabhava and also contribute to the collective nation unit? Because clearly Sri Aurobindo says that India's spiritual destiny has a role to play in the world. And so, how do we kind of reconcile this paradox?
So that's very simple. First is, we must understand that there are three units on which the divine acts. I'm talking of the collectivity. The first is the family, the second is nation, and the third is internationalism. All three are necessary as steps of Vishnu. You can't cancel this and go to the others. Family is the first unit, the place where, the pot, little pot in which the plant is. So we can't say, not like that Aldous Huxley, that, children should be kept in a kind of common facility. No, that's not family. And then the next one. So family is a place where children tend to discover their Swabhava and Swadharma. Because that's where, a child is exposed to the deeper cultural values, which unfortunately a lot has gone away, because this conception is typically Indian. And we have been so much overrun and enamored. See what the Britishers and others, they looted from us was not just wealth, Kohinoor, but a much more precious thing, which was our own cultural and civilizational understanding. I won't even use the word values. So we have to bring that back. So family, nation, and the third. Now your question is about that. Well, on one side there is the nation, on the other side there is the Swadharma. So the nation should be governed by those and in the spirit of the widest. The mother spoke about it, in context of Orwell. She was not in favor of democracy. And Sri Aurobindo says that, democracy is not the way forward. It has outlived its purpose. So she says there should be few people, 4 to 8, but who are very wide, compassionate, and understand this ethos, what is the larger ethos. So people are allowed to explore their Swadharma. There is no problem at all. But if Swadharma ever comes, it won't be Swadharma, will never come in conflict with the nation, because your Swadharma is not like, okay, I won't care about the nation unit. That's not Swadharma. Swadharma is how I will take care of the nation and the world at large. So dharma of a Shudra is that I'll make nice, beautiful things and put it at the disposal of my country, not just for my own advantage, but, to manifest beauty. The Swadharma of the Vaishya is similarly that I'll create beauty, I'll create, a larger, for things to circulate in the world. So Swadharma is never at conflict with a nation unit. It is the egoistic, selfish, and unfortunately, there are doctrines where ideologies and religions. See, there are religions who don't believe in nation unit. They just believe that my religion should have a hegemony over others. They have become political units. Similarly, there are ideologies. That's where the problem comes. So dharma is not a problem. But ideologies and religions which are narrow and fundamentalist, who want only one ideology or one religion to survive and all else to be exterminated, they are a danger and a menace to the world. And one must fight with them ideatively and every whatever way available, because they are a menace and threat to the entire existence of humanity. See, Hitler did it by speaking about the Aryan race. Somebody else may say, well, all who don't believe in my God are kafirs and they have to be finished. A third may say that, well, this ideology is the highest truth and we must, all nations should be brought under that kind of thought. This is dangerous. So, Swadharma is perfectly fine, but it should never be at the cost of the larger interest. In fact, Swadharma will never be in conflict. Swadharma is about how I am expressing myself. If you belong to a nation, you will do that. Help the nation become rich, help humanity become rich. So, it's only egoistic, ideological, religious standards which come in conflict with the nation unit, and they are going to be wiped away. Any religion and ideology which try to impose their own thought structure upon the entire mankind is going to be wiped away. Why Sanatan Dharma has survived and will survive is because of its vast, many-toned multiple approaches which it is inbuilt and ingrained within it, and because it's evolutionary, it takes into account the evolutionary impulse. So that's how I would put it.